Valley, Galen. Neither of us is born. Our birth cries are 10,000 years in the future. Is it so strange, then, to think of seeking a dead queen? Why would she come? I don't know. I only pray that she does, and that her strength will be sufficient. What if she does not? Then the clans will face a difficult day in Axter Glen. What are her chances? Taliesin says they are minimal. What do you say? I'd say Taliesin was being wildly optimistic. Galen returned to Deva at the stream and told her of his mission. She listened quietly, her grey eyes grave. It will be dangerous for you. Take care, she said.
I would be the more careful, he said tenderly, if I knew you would be waiting for me when I returned.
She looked away then, but he took her hand.
I have loved you for such a long time, he told her.
Gently she pulled her hand clear of his.
I love you too, Galen. Not just because you saved my life, but I can't promise to wait for you, nor for any Farland warrior. I know you think me foolish to believe in the prophecy, but Taliesin confirmed it. It is my destiny.
Galen said nothing more. Rising, he moved away, and Deva returned to the waterside. Her thoughts were confused as she sat, trailing her hand in the stream. It was senseless to refuse love when all she had was a distant promise. Deva knew that. Worse, her feelings for Galen had grown stronger during the time they spent together, being hunted by the Aenir. All her doubts surfaced anew, and she remembered confiding in Agwain. He had not scoffed, but he had been brutally realistic.
"Suppose this father of kings never comes? Or worse, suppose he does and he does not desire you? Will you spend your life as a spinster?"
"No, I am not a fool, brother. I will wait one more year, then I will choose either Lane or Galen."
"I am sure they will be glad to hear it," he said.
"Don't be cruel."
"It is not I who am being cruel, Deva. Suppose they don't wait. There are other maidens."
"Then I will marry someone else."
"I hope your dream comes true, but I fear it will not."
"You sadden me, Deva, and I want to see you happy." "A year is not such a long time," she had said.
But that had been before the Aenir invasions, and already it seemed an eternity had passed. Her father was dead, the clan in hiding, the future dark and gloom-laden. Galen chose 6 companions for the journey south: Agwain, Lennox, Lane, Gwalchmai, plus Onik and Ridden. Onik was a quiet clansman, with deep-set eyes and a quick smile. Almost 10 years older than Galen, he was known as a fine fighting man, with quarter-staff or knife. He wore his black hair close-cropped, in the style of the lowland clans, and around his brow sported a black leather circlet, set with a pale grey moonstone. His half-brother, Ridden, was shorter and stockier. He said little, but he had also fought well in the retreat from the valley. Both men had been chosen for their knowledge of the Hasten, gained from the fact that their mother had come from that clan. Taking only light provisions and armed with bows, short swords and hunting knives, the 7 left Valen before dawn. A druid guided them over the invisible bridge, for the twine had been removed lest the Aenir march to the island. Galen had mixed feelings about the trip. The responsibility placed upon him weighed heavily. He loved Caswellan, and trusted him implicitly, but to battle the Aenir on the gentle slopes of Axter Glen? Surely that was madness. During the last 2 years, Galen had enjoyed many conversations with Oracle about battles and tactics, and he had learned of the importance of terrain. A large, well-armed force could not be met head-on by a smaller group. The object should be a score of skirmishes to whittle down the enemy, disrupting his supply lines and weakening his morale. Oracle had likened such war to disease invading the body. Agwain was content. For him, the mission provided an outlet for his grief over the death of his father, and a chance to achieve victory for the Farlan. He didn't know if a Hasten force survived,
but if it did, he would find it. The group moved through Atta Forest, past the swelling Aenea corpses, and on into the first valley. They moved warily, knowing the Aenea could be close. Only in the high passes where the woods were thick and welcoming, and they trusted their skills above those of the enemy, did they relax. Towards dusk, Lennox scouted out a hollow, where they made camp. It was set within a pine wood, and circled by boulders and thick bushes. There was a stream nearby, and Galen lit a small fire. It was a good campsite, and the fire could not be seen outside the ring of trees. Lennox, as always, was hungry, having devoured his 3-day rations by noon. The others mocked him as he sat brooding by the fire, watching them eat. Lennox had grown even larger in the last year, his shoulders and arms heavy with muscle, and he now sported a dark beard, close cropped to his chin. Coupled with a brown goatskin jerkin, it created the appearance of a large, amiable bear.
"We are comrades," he pleaded. "We should share a little."
"I saw some berries on a bush back there," said Gwalchmai. "I am sure they will prove very tasty." He bit into a chunk of oatcake and swung to Agwain. "I think the honey in these cakes is better this year, don't you, Agwain? Thicker. It makes the cake so succulent."
"Decidedly so. It gives them extra flavour." "You are a bunch of swine," said Lennox, pushing himself to his feet.
Laughter followed him as he walked into the darkness in search of berries. The woods were quiet, moon shadows dappling the silver grass. Lennox found the bush and plucked a handful of berries. They served only to heighten his hunger, and he toyed once more with the idea of appealing to his comrades. His stomach rumbled, and he cursed softly. A movement to his right made him turn, dropping into a half-crouch with arms spread. He saw a flash of white cloth disappear beneath a bush, and a tiny leg hastily withdrawn. Lennox ate some more berries, and then ambled towards the bush as if to walk past. As he came abreast of it, he lunged down, pulling the child clear. Her mouth opened, and her face showed her terror, but no sound came out. Lennox took her in his arms, whispering gentle words and stroking her hair. She clung to the goatskin tunic, with her tiny hands clenched tight, the knuckles white as polished ivory.
"There, there, little dove. You're safe. I didn't mean to frighten you. There, there. Don't worry about Lennox. He's big, but he's not bad. He won't hurt you, little dove. You're safe."
And all the while he stroked her head. She burrowed her face into his jerkin, saying nothing. Lennox made his way back to the camp. Instantly his companions gathered around, plying him with questions. He shushed them to silence.
"She's terrified," he said,
keeping his voice low and gentle.
"She must have lost her parents in the woods."
Looking at his comrades, he silently mouthed the words,
"Probably killed by the Aenea."
Gwalchmai, always a favourite with children, tried to get the girl to speak, but she pushed her face deeper into Lennox's jerkin.
"I have never seen a child so frightened," said Agwain. "Where are you from?"
whispered Lennox, kissing her head.
"Tell your uncle, Lennox."
But the child remained silent.
"I don't recognize the girl," he said. "Do you, Gwal?"
"No. She could be Palladies or Hasten or even Farlan, or even a crofter's daughter from the Outlands."
"Well, we can't take her with us," said Ridden. "One of us must take her back to Valon." "I'll do it in the morning," agreed Lennox.
The fire burned low, and the companions took their blankets, ready for an early rise. Lennox sat with his back to a boulder, cuddling the child, who had fallen into a deep sleep. He felt good sitting there. Children had never been easy around him. Lane said his great size frightened them, but whatever the reason, it had always hurt Lennox, who loved the young. In sleep,
The child's face relaxed, but her left hand still clutched his tunic. He pushed her yellow hair back from her eyes, gazing down into her face. She was a pretty little thing, like a doll stuffed with straw. As the night grew chill, Lennox wrapped his blanket around her. A strange thought struck him. This was probably the most important moment of his life. He was not normally a man given to abstract thoughts, but he couldn't help thinking about the child. Here she was, tiny and helpless, full of fear. She had been suffering the worst days of her young life, and now she slept safe in the arms of a powerful man, content that he would look after her. With no more action than a gentle embrace, Lennox had ended her terror. What in life, he wondered, could be more important to her? If her parents were still alive and making for Valen, they must be sick with worry, he thought. But what if, as was likely, they were dead? Lennox chewed the problem over for a while. He would take her to Mary. She was a fine lass with only one child, who would take the girl in and love her into the bargain. The girl's eyes opened. She blinked and yawned. Lennox felt her move and glanced down, stroking her hair. Her eyes were brown, and he smiled at her.
"Are you feeling better?"
he asked.
"You're not my papa."
"No, little dove. I'm your Uncle Lennox."
"My papa's gone. Wolves ate him up," she said, tears glistening. She blinked. "Ate up Jerica, too."
"Wolves?" asked Lennox.
"Big wolves, big as you. Ate him up."
"You've been dreaming, little one. There's no wolves, and certainly none as big as me."
"Lots of wolves," she persisted. "They chased me to eat me up."
"Uncle Lennox won't let them. You're safe now. Go back to sleep. We'll talk in the morning."
"Did you know my papa?"
"No. Was he nice?"
"He played games."
"He sounds like a good man. Where's your mama?"
"Men with swords took her away. She was all bleeding."
"Well, it's over now. You're with your Uncle Lennox, and he's the strongest man in all the world. Nothing will harm you."
"Are you stronger than the wolves?" she asked.
"Aye, lass. I swear upon my soul, no harm will come to you while you're with me. You believe me?"
She smiled, closed her eyes, and put her thumb in her mouth. In the bushes beyond the firelight, blood-red eyes watched for the flames to die down. Taliesin took Caswellan deep underground, to a small chamber set with walls of shining silver and gold. Soft light filled the room, but Caswellan could not see the source. The druid beckoned him to a tall chair of white leather, then sat upon an oak-topped table.
"This is my inner sanctum,"
he told the warrior.
"Here I observe the Farlan, and I keep my notes. Notes no one will read in my lifetime."
He gestured to the shelves, but there were no books there, only small silver cylinders, neatly stacked from floor to ceiling. The far wall was covered with sheets of paper, upon which were curious drawings and symbols. Caswellan studied them.
"What do these represent?"
he asked. Taliesin joined him.
"They are timelines, and chart my attempts to aid Sigarni."
Caswellan ran his eyes over the symbols.
"And the stars?" "Each time Sigarni dies, I mark the spot and pursue a new timeline, a different reality." "It is very complex, Caswellan. Do not seek to stretch your mind around it."
"When must I seek the queen?"
"As soon as you are ready."
"I'm ready now."
"Then observe,"
said the druid. Turning, he walked to the wall by the door and opened a hidden panel. The desktop slid back,
and a screen rose silently from it. Lights blazed from the screen, forming the image of a walled city.
That is Citadel Town, where the Queen currently resides. Currently being a relative term, added the Druid with a dry chuckle.
How is this done? Whispered Caswellan.
It is merely an image. It is summer, and Sigourney has won a great battle. She has returned to the north to celebrate with her captains. The enemy is being pushed back, for now. But the Outland King is gathering a huge force against her. Now, before I send you through, you must understand this, Caswellan. We will meet again on the other side of the gate. Ask me nothing of the events that are transpiring now. Do not speak of the Aenir invasion.
I don't understand.
Taliesin sighed. Trust me, Caswellan. In other realities, our meeting beyond the gate has already taken place many times, and I have found it disadvantageous to view the possible futures. It all becomes too confusing.
Caswellan stood silently for a moment. Then his green gaze fastened on the Druid's dark eyes.
And I have died in these other realities?
He asked.
Yes,
admitted Taliesin.
Do you still wish to go? Can we win if I do not? No. Then let us go.
Taliesin pressed a button on the screen, and the image of the city disappeared. He stood and led Caswellan back to the Druid's Hall and the black arched gate. Meg was waiting there. She stood as he approached, opening her arms, and Caswellan walked into her embrace. She kissed him, her eyes wet with tears.
The world has changed, as you said it would, she told him.
We'll change it back.
I don't think so,
she said sadly.
Even if you beat the Aenir, nothing will ever be quite the way it was.
He did not argue. Instead, he kissed her.
There is one constant fact, Meg. I love you. I always have. I always will.
I have something for you, she said,
pulling away from him. Turning, she lifted a buckskin shirt from the back of a chair. The skin was soft and beige, while on the chest, in crimson-stained leather, was a cunningly crafted hawk, with wings spreading to each shoulder.
If you are to meet a queen, it is fitting you look your best, she said.
Caswellan slipped out of his woolen shirt, donning the buckskin. The fit was perfect.
Leofas stepped from the shadows with Magrig. Are you sure about this plan, Caswellan?
He asked.
No, admitted the warlord. But Taliesin is, and I can think of no other.
Then, may the gods guide you.
The two men shook hands. Taliesin walked to the archway, lifted his hands, and began to chant. The view of the Farlan vanished, to be replaced instantly by a sloping plain and a distant city. Magrig curled his arm around Meg's shoulder.
You will come back, he said.
Caswellan stepped into the archway and vanished. Suddenly the view from the gate disappeared, a blank grey wall replacing it. Meg moved forward and touched the cold stone. Caswellan found himself in a forest glade in the last hour before dusk. Shafts of sunlight lanced the branches of mighty oaks, and birds sang in every tree. But there was no city in sight. Perplexed, he stepped back to where the gate had been. It was gone. Cursing, he drew his short sword and started prodding the air, seeking the entrance. After a few minutes, he gave up and sat back on a jutting tree root. He was loath to leave the spot, and had no idea what plan to pursue. His thoughts were broken by the sound of shouting. Looking around him, he marked the spot in his mind and set off towards the sound. Perhaps the gate had merely sent him too far, and he had come out on the other side of the city. He seemed to recall seeing a wood there. The shouts became triumphant, and Caswellan guessed the men to be hunters who had cornered their prey. Then a voice cried out,
"Lord of heaven, head your servant!"
Caswellan broke into a run. Ahead of him, three men had surrounded a bald, elderly man in robes of grey, who was holding a tightly wrapped bundle in his arms.
"Surrender it, priest," ordered a tall man in a red cape. "You cannot do this," said the old man. "It is against the laws of man and God."
The red-caped warrior stepped forward, a bright sword in his hand. The sword flashed forward. The old man twisted the bundle away from the blade, which lanced into his belly. He screamed and fell.
Caswellan hurdled a fallen tree, his own short sword glinting in the dying light. "What vileness do we have here, my bonnies?"
The three spun round, and the leader walked forward, his sword dripping blood to the grass.
"It's none of your concern, stranger. Be gone. Frightened as I am to face three heroes who can so valiantly tackle old men, I feel I must debate the point," said Caswellan. "Then die!" shouted the man, leaping forward.
Caswellan parried the lunging blade, his own sword flashing through the man's neck. The remaining warriors ran forward. Caswellan blocked the first thrust, hammering a punch to an unprotected chin, and the attacker staggered. Pushing past him, Caswellan engaged the third, slipping his hunting knife into his left hand. He ducked beneath a vicious swipe, slicing his sword behind the man's knee. With a scream, he fell. Caswellan whirled as the second man was almost upon him, sword plunging for his chest, but Caswellan parried the blow, punching his hunting knife through the man's tunic. The blade slid between the man's ribs, cleaving the heart. Dragging the knife free, he saw the third man crawling towards the bushes, leaving a trail of blood behind him. Ignoring him, Caswellan ran to the old man, gently turning him.
"Thank this source," said the priest, "for he has sent you in my hour of need."
Blood was seeping fast, drenching the old man's clothes.
"Why did they attack you?"
"It wasn't me, my son. They wanted the babe."
The old man pointed to the bundle by his side. Caswellan lifted the blanket, and there lay a sleeping infant, no more than a week old. She was tiny and naked, her downy hair pure white.
"Lie still," urged Caswellan,
ripping open the priest's robes, seeking to stem the outflow of blood from the wound. The assassin's sword had ripped down through the man's lower belly, opening the artery in his groin. There was no hope for him, and his face was already losing colour.
"Where are you from?"
whispered the dying man.
"Another world," said Caswellan, "and I am lost."
The old man's eyes gleamed.
"You passed through a gate?"
"Yes."
"Was it Mordic sent you?"
"No."
"Cataris, Blean, Taliesin?"
"Yes, Taliesin."
"Take the babe back through the chalice gate."
"I do not know where it is."
"Close by. North. I opened it myself. Look for a cave on the hillside. It has a goblet fashioned in the rock of the entrance. But beware, Jakuta Khan will follow."
"Who are you?"
"Astole. I was Taliesin's teacher."
Horns sounded in the forest to the south.
"They are coming for the child. Take her and run. Go now. I beg you."
The old man slumped back. Sheathing his sword and knife, Caswellan scooped the bundle into his arms and began to run. Behind him he could hear the barking of dogs and the shrill call of hunting horns. He was angry now. Thwarted from his quest, he was being hunted by an enemy he did not know in a forest which was strange to him. Dropping his pace to a gentle jog, eyes scanning the undergrowth, he searched for a way to lose his pursuers. He could hear running water away to the left, and he cut towards it. A small stream gurgled over rocks. Splashing into it,
Caswellan followed it upstream for about 30 paces, and then left it on the same side, walking through soft mud, to stop before a massive oak. Without turning, he looked down and walked backwards, placing his feet in his own prints. Slowly he backtracked to the stream, then carried on walking through the water. It was an old trick, which in daylight would fool no skilled tracker, but with dusk approaching fast, it could hold up the pursuit. The child opened her eyes, pushing her tiny fist into her mouth. Caswellan cursed. She was hungry, and that meant there were scant moments left before she began to cry for food. Turning again towards the north, he scanned the hillside for the cave the old man had spoken of. The babe in his arms gave out a thin, piercing wail, and Caswellan cursed again. The sun was slowly sinking behind the western peaks. As it fell below the clouds, a shaft of bright light lit the hillside, and Caswellan saw the dark shadow of the cave entrance, some 30 paces above him and to the right. The barking of hounds was closer. Twisting, he saw four sleek black shapes emerge from the tree line below, no more than 50 paces behind him. Holding firm to the child, Caswellan sprinted up the slope and into the cave. It was like a short tunnel. Behind him, the dying sun was bright against the rocks, yet ahead was a forest bathed in moonlight. Caswellan spun, for the first of the hounds had reached the cave. As it leapt, his sword slashed down across its neck, smashing through flesh and bone. Turning again, he saw the moonlit forest begin to fade. Taking two running steps, he hurled himself through the gateway. He fell heavily, bracing his arm and shoulder so that the babe would be protected. Rolling to his feet, he swung to face his enemies, and found himself staring at a solid wall of grey stone. The sound of a waterfall came to him, and he sheathed his sword and walked towards it. "I know this place," he thought, "but the trees are different." This was Ironhand's pool, and if he climbed above the falls, he would see Hydruin in the distance. The wind shifted, bringing the smell of wood smoke to his nostrils. Moving to his left, into the wind, the smell grew stronger. Ahead was a cottage of stone with a thatched roof, and a cleared yard containing a small flower garden and a coop for chickens. Caswellan ran to the cottage, tapping softly at the door. It was opened by a young woman with long, fair hair. "What do you want?" she asked, her eyes wide with fear.
"Food for a beeb," he answered, handing her the child.
Her eyes changed as she gazed at the small face.
"Come inside."
Caswellan followed her. At a pine table sat a large man with a heavy beard of red gold.
"Welcome," said the man.
Caswellan noticed that one of his hands was below the table and guessed a blade was hidden there.
"I found the babe in the forest," he said lamely.
The man and woman exchanged glances.
"Do you know whose child it is?"
the man asked.
"I know nothing of her," said Caswellan. "We lost our own daughter 3 days ago," said the man. "That is her crib there, in the corner. You can leave the child with us, if you will. My wife is still milk-swelled, as you can see."
The woman had opened her shirt and was feeding the babe. Caswellan pulled up a chair and seated himself opposite the man, looking deep into his clear grey eyes.
"If I leave her with you, will you care for her as you would your own?"
"Aye,"
said the man.
"Walk with me a while."
He rose, sheathing the hunting knife he had held below the table. He was taller than Caswellan and broader in the shoulder. Stepping out into the night, he walked to the far side of the cabin, seating himself on a bench crafted from pine. Caswellan sat beside him.
"Who are you?" he asked. "Your clothes are clan, but you're not Loda."
"I am Caswellan of the Farlan."
"I have dealings with the Farlan. Who is it? I've never heard of you."
Caswellan let out a sigh and leaned back against the bench.
"Is there a town near here, on the edge of the lowlands, called Atarus?"
The man shook his head.
There is Citadel Town. The Outlanders control it now. And I ask you again, who are you?
I am a clansman, as I have said. He laughed suddenly.
Were our positions reversed, my friend, and you were to tell me the story of how you found the babe, I would think you mad.
I am not you,
said the man.
So, speak.
Quietly, Caswellan told him of the Aenea invasion, and of his journey through the gateway, of the dying priest, the men and hounds who had sought the death of the child. The man did not interrupt, but listened intently. As he finished, Caswellan stood and looked down into the man's deep-set grey eyes, awaiting a response. At that moment, the ground trembled. Thrown off balance, Caswellan lurched to the right. The moonlight brightened, and gazing up, both men saw two moons shining in the sky. For moments only, the land was bathed in silver brilliance. Then the second moon faded. As it did so, the figure of Taliesin appeared beside them. The old man stumbled and fell to his knees as the crofter leapt to his feet, his knife snaking into his hand.
No! Shouted Caswellan. He is the druid I told you of!
Taliesin tried to stand, failed, and sat glumly on the ground.
I think the journey almost killed me,
he grumbled. As Caswellan helped him to his feet, the little sorcerer sighed.
You have no idea of the energy I have expended to arrive here. Who is this?
I am Chi,
said the crofter.
I must see the child,
said Taliesin, shaking himself free of Caswellan's support and moving off to the cabin. Che approached Caswellan.
You were wrong. I did not think you mad. Yesterday, an old man came to us as we were mourning the death of our babe. He told us he would come, and that he would bring us joy and sorrow.
This man, was he bald and wearing grey robes? Che nodded. Both men returned to the cabin to find Taliesin kneeling beside the crib, where the baby was sleeping. When Caswellan and Che looked closely, they saw that the child's silver hair was now corn gold. Taliesin stood and turned towards the crofter.
Enemies will come after this babe,
he said.
Be warned. I have changed the colour of her hair. As I have told your wife, you must raise her as your own. No one must know how she came here. Your wife says the death of your child is not known among your friends in the clan. Keep it that way.
Who is she?
Asked Che.
Why is she in danger?
She is your daughter.
You need know no more than that, save that she is of the blood royal,
said Taliesin.
Now, we must go.
Lennox added fuel to the fire, and the flames leapt and twisted. He wasn't cold. He merely wanted to see the child's face in sleep. Her thumb had slipped from her open mouth, and she was breathing evenly. Lennox carefully hitched her into the crook of his right arm, stretching his back. Galen yawned and stretched, sitting up and rubbing his eyes. Seeing Lennox still awake, he moved round the fire to join him.
How is she?
She's all right now. She says her father was eaten by wolves, and her sister.
It's unlikely, said Galen.
She would not have escaped a pack. A dream, do you think?
I don't know. She said the wolves were as big as me.
Wolves attack at night, and they move fast. A child that small might think them over large.
I agree, Galen. But she's clan. Her father was clan. Who could he be surprised by wolves? It makes no sense. I can't remember a clansman ever being killed by a pack. Wolves don't attack men. I've never heard of such a thing. Perhaps he had no fire, or had been forced to flee without weapons. Perhaps the wolves were starving.
The two men sat in silence for a while. Then Galen spoke.
More likely it was the Aenir, and the child was confused. Many of them wear wolfskin cloaks, and at the games I saw a man with a wolf's head for a helm. An attack at night. She says her mother was killed by men with swords. I don't think she's that confused. I think you should walk warily tomorrow, said Lennox.
We'll miss you on the trip, said Galen, gripping Lennox's shoulder.
Yes, but you don't need me. She does. I'll get her to the island and then join my father. We'll see you in Axter Glen.
I hope so. I pray there is an army of Highlanders ready to be gathered. But if not, I shall still see you there, Lennox, even if I am alone. I promise you.
I know you will, cousin. I'll look forward to it.
Soon after dawn, the companions bade farewell to Lennox and the child and set off to the south. Lennox hoisted the girl to his shoulder and headed north. As they walked, he discovered that her name was Plessy and her clan Hasten. She was the niece of Larrick, the hunt lord. He was tempted to run back and find the others, for Larrick would be well disposed towards a group which had rescued his niece. But Plessy's fearful glances behind them forced him to dismiss the idea. Whatever had happened to her had left a terrible scar. Throughout the morning he climbed through the timberline, and they stopped to eat at a rock pool below a small falls. The companions had given Lennox some oatcakes, and these he shared with Plessy. The child sat upon a rock, dangling her feet in the water, giggling at its icy touch. Lennox smiled and froze. He slowly climbed to his feet, aware suddenly that he was being watched. Fear grew in his heart. Not fear for himself, but for the child. He had promised she would be safe, and a promise was a sacred thing among the clans. Casually he glanced around at the thick undergrowth. He spotted a patch of darkness beyond a blossoming heather, but allowed his eyes to skip over the bush. He had the feeling the dark patch was fur. And if that was so, the thing was either a bear or a wolf. Plessy was sitting in the shade of a tall pine, and a long branch extended above the water. Lennox scooped her into his arms and lifted her high onto the branch.
"Sit there for a moment, little dove," he said.
"Don't want to," she wailed.
"Do it for your uncle, Lennox, and be careful now."
Even as he spoke, a werebeast charged from the undergrowth, jaws wide, taloned fingers reaching for the clansman. As it leapt, it gave a terrifying howl. Beasts of the wild always roar or screech on attacking their prey. The sound freezes the victim. But Lennox was not a hunted animal, nor even an ordinary man. He was the most powerful warrior in the long history of the Farlan. As the beast broke cover, Lennox whirled, bellowing his own scream of fury. He charged it, smashing a right cross to its open jaws. Fangs snapped, the jawbone disintegrating under the impact. The beast screamed and fell, rolling to all fours and howling in pain. A second creature leapt forward, and twisting to meet it, Lennox charged again. Talons lashed across his shoulder, scoring deep through the flesh. The jaws lunged for his face, and throwing up his hand, he fastened his fingers to the furry throat. The downward lunge was halted, the fangs inches from his face. Lennox could feel hot, rancid breath on his skin. The power of the beast was immense. He threw a left-hand blow, which thundered against the werebeast's ear. The creature fell back, then leapt again. This time Lennox stood his ground until the beast was almost upon him. As it rushed forward, he caught it by the throat and groin, and hurled it with all his strength against the trunk of a pine. It hit with a sickening thud, spine exploding into shards, ribs splitting and piercing the great lungs beneath, blood flowing from his wounds. Lennox drew his sword. The first beast attacked again, its jaw hanging slack. As its talons lashed out, Lennox ducked beneath the swinging arm and hammered his sword into its unprotected belly. The creature writhed in agony, then crumpled to the earth, thrashing in its death throes. Lennox dragged his sword loose and drew his hunting knife, eyes scanning the bushes. There was no movement there, but he had to be sure.
"Stay in the tree, Plessy. Uncle Lennox won't be a moment."
She wailed. "Don't leave me! Wolves eat me up!"
Her tears cut through him, but he moved on, searching the tracks within the undergrowth. Satisfied there were only two of the creatures, he returned to the weeping child, lifting her down and cuddling her.
"There, there, you see? It was only a moment or two. Don't leave me again, Uncle Lennox." "I won't. Now, you are going to have to be a brave girl and help me to stop this bleeding. Can you do that?"
With a grunt of pain, Lennox removed his ripped shirt. There were four deep slashes across his right shoulder blade, but he could reach none of them.
"There's lots of blood, Uncle Lennox."
"The bleeding will clean the wounds," he said, moving to his pack. "Can you sew?"
"Mother taught me," said Plessy.
"That's good, little one."
Rummaging into his pack, he found needle and thread.
"I want you to close these little scratches for me. Then we'll move on. Will you do that for me?"
"I don't know how."
Lennox could see the fear returning to her.
"It's easy,"
he told her, forcing a smile.
"Trust me. I'll show you. First, thread the needle. My hands are too big and clumsy for it."
Plessy took the thread, licked the end and carefully inserted it into the eye of the needle. She looked up expectantly at Lennox. Twisting his head, he could see the ragged red line of the first cut on the top of his shoulder. Taking the needle, he pricked it through the skin.
"You do it like this,"
he told her, as a wave of nausea hit him.
"Just like this."
Plessy began to cry.
"You're not going to die, are you, Uncle Lennox?"
"From little scratches like this, no. Now, come round to my back and show me your sewing."
Taliesin led Caswellan away from the cabin and on into the trees. It was not cold, but the breeze brought a promise of autumn in the air.
"The child will be the future queen, if she lives,"
said the druid. Caswellan stopped.
"What do you mean, if she lives? We know she lives. I watched her die after the killing of the beast."
Taliesin gave a dry laugh.
"My boy, you saw once the Garney, but it would take too long to explain the infinite possibilities when one deals in time, the paradoxes created. Merely hold to the concept of impossibility made reality. This child is in great danger. First and foremost is the sorcerer Jakuta Khan. He was hired to bring about the fall of the king, Sigarni's real father, and in exchange he was offered wealth and the life of the king's daughter. He's a gifted magicker, Caswellan. He will track her down. The crofter cannot stand against him."
Caswellan sat down on a fallen tree.
"The thought fills me with sorrow, Taliesin. But what can we do? My people need me. I cannot stay here and protect the babe. Nor can you. We do not have the time." "That word again. Time," responded Taliesin, sitting beside the taller man. "It matters not how long we wait here, for when you return, no time will have passed in the world you know. There is a small settlement close by. We will rest there and be offered food. Then we will journey back to the falls and make camp, by the rock face where the gateway opened. There you will see in one day what few mortals will ever see."
The following evening, Caswellan built a small fire by the rock face, and the two men sat eating a meal of honey biscuits and watching the fragmented moon dance upon the rippling water of the falls' pools.
"How long do we wait?"
asked Caswellan.
"Until I feel the magic of Jakuta Khan,"
said Taliesin.
"But now, there is someone I must summon."
Rising, the little sorcerer moved to the poolside. As Caswellan watched, Taliesin began to chant in a low voice. The wind died down, and a mist formed above two boulders close to the pool's edge. Caswellan's eyes widened as the mist rose into an arch some 10 paces in front of the sorcerer. Tiny lights like fireflies glittered in the archway, and then a man appeared, tall,
impossibly broad-shouldered, wearing a silver breastplate and a shining mail shirt of silver steel. His hair was moon-white, his beard braided.
"Who calls Ironhand?"
he asked, his voice low and deep like distant thunder. Caswellan rose and walked to stand beside Taliesin.
"I call upon you, High King,"
said the sorcerer.
"I, Taliesin, the Druid Lord. Your daughter lives, but she is in peril." "They killed me here,"
said the ghostly warrior.
"My body lies beneath those boulders. They killed my wife, and I cannot find her spirit. But your daughter lives. The babe sleeps in a cabin close by. And the hunters will come for her. The demons will stalk her." "What can I do, Taliesin? I am a spirit now." "You can do nothing against men of flesh, Ironhand. But I have planted a seed in the child's mind. When the demons materialize, she will flee here. The creatures, though flesh, are also summoned through the spirit spells. You can fight them."
"When you need me, call upon me," said the Ghost King.
The archway shimmered and vanished, and Caswellan once more felt the night breeze upon his skin. "She is Ironhand's daughter! Sweet heaven!"
"Aye,"
whispered Taliesin.
"She is of the blood most royal. Now, let us return to the fire. There is a spell I must cast before I leave you."
The druid banked up the fire and once more began to chant. Caswellan sat silently until he had finished. Then, Taliesin took a deep breath.
"There is a man I must see. He is a dreamer and a drunkard, but we will need him before long. Stay here, and do not for any reason venture from the fire."
He smiled.
"I think what you are about to see will keep you well entertained until I return."
Rising, he ambled away along the line of the pool. Caswellan leaned back against the rock face. Suddenly, the moon sped across the sky. The sun flashed up to bathe the pool in brilliant light. Then, as suddenly as it had come, the sun fell away, and the moon reappeared. Astonished, Caswellan gazed around the pool. There was no sound now, but night and day appeared and disappeared in seconds. Beyond the firelight, the grass grew long, withered and dried, died and was replaced. Trees sprouted branches before his eyes, leaves opened, glistened, withered and fell. Within the space of a moment, snow appeared beyond the fire, thick and deep. Then it was gone, instantly replaced by the flowers of spring. He watched the seasons pass by in heartbeats, in blazes of colour and streams of light. When the snow had appeared for the sixth time, the rushing of time began to slow. The moon reared up and stopped in mid-heaven. The cold of winter now whispered past Taliesin's spell, and Caswellan shivered. Movement to his right caught his eye, and he saw Taliesin trudging through the snow towards him. The old man was carrying a short hunting bow and a quiver of arrows.
"How did you make the seasons move so fast?" asked Caswellan.
"Not even I can do that," answered Taliesin wearily. "You are sitting beside a gateway. I merely activated it. It flickered you through the years."
"It is a memory I shall long treasure," said the clansman.
"Sadly, we have no time to dwell upon it," Taliesin told him, "for the evil is almost upon us."
He squatted down by the fire, holding out his long, thin fingers to the flames.
"I am so cold," he said, "and tired."
He handed Caswellan the bow and arrows.
"What are we facing?" asked the clansman, stringing the bow and testing the pull. It was a sturdy weapon.
"Men would call them demons, and so they are. But they are also flesh and blood from another dimension. Another land, if you will. They are huge beasts, Caswellan, some reaching 8 feet tall. And build, they are much like great bears, but they move with greater speed and are upright like men. Their fingers are taloned, each talon the length of your hunting knife. They have fangs also and short curved tusks. They do not use the tusks in combat. These are for ripping flesh from the leather-skinned beasts they have hunted in their own world.
Should we not make our way to Che's cabin? He cannot face them alone.
Taliesin shook his head.
Che's life is over, boy. It was over the minute he agreed to take the babe. The beasts will materialize there.
What?
They will be conjured there, snapped Taliesin. Jakuta Khan is a spell master. He has located Sigourney and will cause the beast to appear inside the cabin. I have observed him, Caswellan. He has used these beasts before. He makes them invisible to the human eye. The first moment the victim knows of their existence is when the talons rip out his heart. Trust me, we do not want to be inside the cabin when that happens.
How then do we save the babe?
She is no longer a babe. You have seen the seasons fly by, and she is 6 now, and she will make her way here. I planted a seed in her mind, and that of her mother. As soon as the terror manifests itself, both will act instinctively. The child will run here.
Caswellan rose and tied the quiver to his belt. And how am I to fight these invisible beasts? He asked softly.
As best you can, clansman. Come, kneel by me, and I will give you all that I can.
Dropping to one knee, Caswellan looked into the old man's eyes. The druid was more than tired. His eyes were dull and purple-ringed, his skin dry. Lifting his hand, Taliesin covered Caswellan's eyes and began to chant. Heat emanated from his fingers, lancing into Caswellan's brain like an arrow of fire. The clansman groaned, but Taliesin's voice whispered to him,
"Hold on, boy. It will not last much longer."
The hand fell away, and Caswellan opened his eyes.
"What have you done?" he whispered.
The trees by the pool had changed now, becoming sharp and unreal like a charcoal sketch upon virgin paper. Taliesin's features could no longer be seen. He was merely a glowing form of many colours, red in the belly and eyes, purple over the heart, the rest a shifting mix of orange, yellow and white.
"No, you will see them, Caswellan," said the shimmering druid. "They will come from the south, hard on the heels of the child. Best you find a place to smite them."
"How many will come?"
"I would guess at 2. It needs a mighty spell to summon just one. Jakuta Khan will expect little resistance from a crofter, but there might be more. He is young and arrogant in his strength."
Caswellan moved out onto the frozen pool and headed south, moving high into the tree line. An old oak stood beside the trail, its 2 main branches some 10 feet high, spreading out like the arms of a supplicant. Caswellan climbed to the right-hand branch and sat with his back to the tree bole. His thoughts were many as he waited for the beasts. He had never lacked physical courage. In fact, he had often courted danger merely for the thrill of it. But now, the Fallen were under threat, and his wife and child were in peril in another world. No longer able to afford the luxury of danger, he felt fear rise within him. What if he died here? What would become of the Fallen or Maeg and Donal? His mouth was dry. His thoughts swung to the child, Sigourney, an innocent hunted by demons. Yet what was her life when set against his entire clan?
"I will fight, but I cannot die for you," he said softly. "I cannot risk that."
His decision made, he relaxed. Looking down at the glimmering colours that were his hands, he realised that the fingers had become difficult to see, and they were cold. He rubbed his palms together and looked again. For a few heartbeats, they shone with a dull red light, then faded once more. Tugging his fleece-lined gloves from his belt, he pulled them on. Ice formed in his beard as he waited in the tree. Glancing back, he saw the shimmering colours he recognised as Taliesin moving across the ice. The old man must be frozen, he thought. The cloak of feathers would do little to keep out the bitter cold. A bestial scream tore through the silence of the night.
Caswellan removed his gloves and notched an arrow to the bowstring. For some moments there was no movement. Then a small figure ran into sight, the colours glowing around her bright and rich. The figure stumbled and rolled in the snow. Pulling his gaze from her, Caswellan looked back up the trail. Something huge loomed over the hillside. Then another. To his left was a third, moving through the trees. Caswellan cursed, gauging the beast to be around 8 feet tall. The first of the creatures lumbered down the slope. Its colours were strong, mostly purple, orange and red. The purple area spread from the neck to the belly in 2 vertical circles, joined by a red ridge. Caswellan drew back on the bowstring until it touched his right cheek. Then he let fly. The arrow hammered home in the upper circle of purple, and instantly the colour changed, flowing from the wound as golden light. Caswellan loosed a second shaft that punched through the lower circle. The creature gave a terrifying shriek, tottered to the left, and fell heavily. Twisting round, Caswellan saw that the child had reached the poolside. 2 beasts were converging on her. Of Taliesin there was no sign. Dropping from the tree, Caswellan notched an arrow and raced down the icy slope. His foot struck a tree root hidden by snow, and he was pitched forward. Releasing the bow, he tried to roll over and stop his slide, his hands scrabbling at the snow. Another tree root saved him, his fingers curling round it. Scrambling to his feet, he saw the first of the beasts almost upon the helpless child. His bow was some 20 paces up the slope. Drawing his short sword and hunting knife, Caswellan ran forward. As the beast reared up, he ducked under a sweeping slash from a taloned paw and stabbed his knife hilt deep into the creature's belly. A backhanded blow took him high on the shoulder, lifting him from his feet and hurling him through the air. Falling hard, he struck his left shoulder against a tree trunk, paralyzing his arm. The mortally wounded beast staggered and fell, but the third demon reared up and advanced on the clansman. With an angry curse, Caswellan rose, eyes glittering. "Run, you fool!" shouted Taliesin as the beast loomed before the clansman. Deep in his heart, Caswellan knew that he should take that advice. There was so much to live for, so much still to be achieved. The beast turned away from him, towards the child at the water's edge. In that moment, Caswellan felt relief flood over him. He was safe. "I live and she dies," he thought suddenly. Without further thought, he took 3 running steps and hurled himself at the beast, plunging his sword into its broad back. The creature screamed and spun. The sword was ripped from the clansman's hand but remained jutting from the beast's rainbow flesh. Talons ripped into Caswellan's shoulder, pain searing through him as he was thrown to the ground. In that moment, a bright light blazed, and Caswellan saw the massive, shimmering figure of Ironhand standing over the child, sword held 2-handed and raised high. The beast gave a low growl and sprang at the ghost. The dead king stepped forward to meet it, his silver sword slashing through the air in a glittering arc. It passed through the creature, seemingly without leaving a wound. But the demon froze, tottered, and toppled backwards to the snow. Taliesin emerged from his hiding place in the undergrowth and ran to the child. Caswellan's vision blurred, the spell placed over his eyes fading. He blinked and saw the druid kneeling beside Sigarni. The girl was sitting silently, her eyes wide open and unblinking. Taliesin placed his hand on the child's head.
"Is she hurt?"
asked the ghost king. Taliesin shook his head.
"Her body is safe, her spirit scarred," he said.
With a groan, Caswellan pushed himself to his feet. Blood was flowing freely from the gash to his shoulder.
"What will happen to her now?" "There is one coming who will look after her. His name is Gwalch. He is a mystic,"
Taliesin told him.
"I hope this is an end to her adventures with demons," said Caswellan. "It is not," whispered Taliesin. "But the next time, she must fight them alone." "Not alone," said the king, "for I shall be here."
With time against him, Galen led the companions over the most hazardous terrain. skirting the Aenea army on the third day of travel. From their hiding place on a wooded hillside, the companions gazed down on the horde,